It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley, they're back from Build. They've got all the deets, everything that happened after our show last week. We'll also talk about a surprising patch for Windows XP and the new folding Lenovo PC. It's all coming up next on Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. Episode 621, recorded Wednesday, May 15th, 2019. I want to be your Rhoda. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra is software selection simplified. Visit Capterra's free website at capterra.com/windows. And by IT Pro TV, providing effective training with access to virtual labs and practice tests. Visit go.itpro.tv/windows to take advantage of their lowest prices of the season. For an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription, use the offer code WW30 at checkout. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is an enterprise-class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3 and up to 6 times faster with no hidden fees for egress or API requests. Calculate your savings and try Wasabi with free unlimited storage for a month at wasabi.com, code Windows. It's time for Windows Weekly. Yay! I always look forward to this all week long so we can talk about Linux. Paul Thurrott is here from Thurrott.com. Mary Jo Foley from allaboutmicrosoft.com. Paul represents consumers. Mary Jo represents enterprise. I represent dunderheads. So it's
never
covered.
The twain shall meet.
Ne'er the twain. That's why we have a line between you, a thin but impermeable membrane in between the two.
There's a little crossover sometimes.
So how did it go the rest of Build? You had a meetup that night and had fun?
That was good.
Yeah, that went well. Anything to report?
It was a busy show. Yeah, we do have a lot more to report.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, I have to confess that I think he did the right thing. Satya Nadella's keynote was very enterprise and very developer focused, and so not so sexy, which is fine with me.
Sure.
And I mean, that's what it is. Sometimes I think companies forget that, and they do these keynotes that are for consumers.
So visionary that you're not sure who it's for.
Yeah, and of course, that's always been a problem with Mr. Nadella. He really likes the vision thing, and they even called it the vision.
There's a little bit of hubris to that, isn't there? It's like the vision keynote. I mean,
well, I guess the idea is this is kind of the 30,000-foot level of where we want to go with it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I hope they're parachutes, though, because they're pretty much in the cloud.
We're going to need a bigger parachute. One of the things that we learned was that Windows 10 is on a lot of computers. Windows 10. Now, Windows, how many computers is Windows on?
1.5 billion.
Okay. Which means that Android is the most widely used operating system.
Oh, yeah.
With two because Google 2.5. Said 2.5 billion after the
That's right.
So in a way, we could say that's a win for Linux.
Yeah, we're not going to say that, Leo.
could we say that?
We could.
Linux in the pocket top. but 1.5 billion. But what's amazing is that more than half of all Windows users are using Windows 10 now. That's actually quite a success story, right? Mm-hmm. How does that compare to Windows 7, for instance, when it was in its heyday?
Oh, in its heyday. That's actually, I'm not really sure about that. The problem for Windows 7, the XP was around for a good chunk of that.
Yeah.
Windows 8 didn't do too much damage.
XP's kind of still around.
It is. We'll talk about that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Not as much as before, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't either. I haven't looked at that lately. Like, X number of years in, what was Windows 7's share versus XP?
I don't think it was ever above 65%. Two-thirds, roughly.
What is it now for Windows 10? It's more than half, right?
It is more than half. I mean, you know, 1,500 divided by 825 is, you know, whatever that
it's
is.
825 million Windows 10 users.
Yeah, so that's probably close to, what, 60% almost?
That's impressive. Something. That's amazing.
Yeah, and, it, you know, assuming they never go past Windows 10, you know, Windows 10 will eventually be roughly 100% because Windows 7 will leave support. It will keep going down. Of course, what we need to do at that point is break it down by version. But even then, it's skewed because Microsoft is forcing upgrades over set periods of time. So, you know, in the past, you had 10 years, if you wanted to run a version of Windows. You do not have 10 years to run any version of Windows 10. You have 2 years, I think,
except
or 3 years.
Except LTSC, right? Isn't that okay. the one
yeah.
exception?
Yeah, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Right. That's true. That's true. But, I mean, the majority
long-term of servicing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what number I would love to see? What percentage of Windows 10 is on LTSC? We don't know
I'd love
that
to see numbers like that. Yep. Yeah, well, yeah. I don't think they'll ever show that.
No, because they're trying to discourage people from doing that. They want them to be on the always latest feature update. And
yeah.
But IT has pushed back on that a lot, and a lot of IT shops have used the LTSC version to basically not take the updates.
I mean, if you think about Windows 10 over time and you think about the big updates, the small updates, whatever, and it really hasn't changed all that much, right? I mean,
no, it hasn't.
From a user experience standpoint, there have been tweaks here and there, lots of little tweaks. But I mean, honestly, it's been pretty consistent for almost 4 years now.
Yeah.
They didn't. Did they talk a little bit about how many are 1809 or 1803?
They didn't talk about this at all. I got this from an internal document.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right. I read that. Yeah. Therot.com has learned.
The last official number.
You gotta be judicious about how you write that later.
Yeah, you do. March, they told us 800 million. That was a public number. But this 825 million number is not a number they shared publicly.
I feel like they should update it over time. There's nothing embarrassing about it. It's not like it's bad.
No, in fact, it sounds like it's good, but maybe it's just
me. It's like the second biggest show of the year. I suppose there are other milestones to come. Obviously, the Windows 10 anniversary is this July. They have their partner conference. I assume they're still doing that in Las Vegas this year.
Yeah.
Be kind of a place to do that. And then Ignite, of course, in the fall. But if I was betting money, and I'm not, but if I was, I'd probably bet on Ignite for the next update on this number.
Yeah, me too.
Official update.
Yeah.
Well, good. All right. So it's not cause for celebration, or Microsoft would have said it out loud, but nor is it anything shabby. It's pretty good.
The key takeaway that I have, if you look at the numbers that Microsoft has provided and then this number, which it provided internally, is that the Windows 7 upgrade cycle has never resulted in a giant tsunami of upgrades. And I obviously, with roughly 35-40% of the install base still running Windows 7, that could and probably will change. The only question is what percentage of businesses elect to pay Microsoft extra support over 1 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. And that might spread it out and make it seem like less of a big wave. And that's kind of my expectation, I guess.
Yeah, same. We've talked about this a couple times when the earnings report happens. Investors always ask Microsoft, so, you know, when's the big momentum going to come from these Windows 7 upgraders? And they keep saying, well, not yet. So that makes you wonder, is it ever going to?
I think they've been seeing it in a very steady way.
Me too. More slow and steady, you know, than all of a sudden here's 100 million or 200 million.
That's the way it works. I mean, that's the way the enterprise is. It's possible in the fourth quarter, the first quarter next year, we might see a bigger than usual bump. I think we did see that in one recent quarter, but I'm not expecting a surge, you know, in one quarter or whatever.
And I was very interested. Yesterday we talked a little bit on MacBreak Weekly about progressive web apps and why I thought it was really important for Apple. Apple, as you know, lost a big Supreme Court case this week. They didn't lose a lot of money. That just the Supreme Court said that Apple, yes, indeed, can be sued by consumers.
So we have this in the notes for later.
Okay. Well, the reason
actually, I think this
it came up, it brought up PWA, is because one way Apple could get around this, you know, accusation of monopoly in the App Store, is if they made it possible to write web apps that were every bit as good as App Store apps using progressive web apps. And so full support for PWA to me And of course, Google and Microsoft are already way behind PWA, but Apple needs to get behind it too. And then this can really happen, I think.
So there are indications they are moving in that direction, right? Every version of Safari that comes out has additional features related to PWA. Right. I just literally saw a story about this before the show started, that they're actually going to support some notion of performance throttling for PWA so that they can't take over the system. I think one of the concerns that Apple probably has about apps outside of stores, outside of their stores, is that they don't follow some set of rules or whatever. Right. Right?
The biggest issue, I think, right now for PWAs is persistent storage on Safari. You know, they've got service workers, but they don't have a fully complete set yet.
And this is something Apple could do today, right? I mean, to be clear,
absolutely should. And I think the Supreme Court. Yes. The good news is this may force them to do this. Microsoft. I didn't talk about PWAs at the keynote, nor did Google. No. But I was very curious if they talked about them later. We should explain. We've talked about it before, but progressive web apps are basically websites that can be saved onto the desktop as an icon on either mobile or desktop and become effectively applications that run even offline.
So I would add to that because you can, in modern browsers, pin websites and they become sort of like apps. PWAs really are apps in that they take on native app capabilities, and it varies per platform, but you were talking about local storage or the ability to run offline or access the native notification system, use something like jump lists on Windows or the press and hold actions you have on other platforms and so forth. There's a long list of that stuff. So,
and it's important for Microsoft because they don't have a mobile platform.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And the PWA story on Windows is kind of interesting. I mean, just to kind of preface this year, we should go back in time about a year and a half. And Microsoft at that time was announcing that their intention to add PWA to the Windows 10 platform. And they were doing it in a way that was very different from what Google was doing at the time, which is that Google would install PWAs on your device using Android. And they've since brought that to the using the web browser. And they've since brought that to the desktop with Chrome OS as well. You can, and actually Windows and any other supported platform, but you can install the apps on the platform from the browser.
Yeah,
you know, Microsoft was taking a mobile app approach.
You can see why Google wants this because it makes Chrome OS an operating system. You know, I mean, it's You can see but Apple liking this.
You know, it's interesting because to kind of set this. So the thing that Microsoft brought to the table was, we're going to treat PWAs like mobile apps. We're going to allow you to install them from the store. And just as when you go to the store and you browse apps, you don't know if it was written in C++ or in C# or what APIs they used or, you know, what libraries or whatever. It's just an app. So these apps just are kind of in the store. They sit next to other apps. You have no idea that they're web apps in many cases. There are some high-profile examples. We always talk about Twitter. But, you know, Starbucks is a PWA. Tinder is a PWA. Pinterest is a PWA. Hulu is a PWA. And the advantage of that approach, not the store approach, but just going the PWA approach, is that you don't have to maintain multiple apps on different platforms, right? Usually with different developer teams responsible for each version. So if you want to support Android, iOS, Windows, Mac, maybe Linux, whatever, you required in many cases different teams for each one of those apps. They're different apps, you know, and sometimes they're updated a little differently. Sometimes Android will have one feature that iOS doesn't, or vice versa, or whatever. And so this gives you that single code base effect if you can do a PWA. And in the case of Windows, which has not been a very successful mobile apps platform, to say the least, the ability to support PWA is very important because it brings apps into the store that never would have come otherwise. And the two that Microsoft cited to me were Pinterest and Tinder. They never would have made store apps for Windows, ever. But because Windows supported PWA, it was just a checkbox to click, and it worked. You know, instantly worked.
Were you surprised they didn't play this up more though at Build? Every year, I feel like we go into Build and we're like, okay, this is when they're going to really start talking about PWAs. And even again, this Build, it was very low key what they said about it, right?
Yeah. So by the way, I think you and I and maybe Windows enthusiasts in general fall back into a very general pattern of, things don't happen the way we expect them to, and then we say, "Well, just wait for Build next year. Everything's going to,
yeah,
and then Build, comes." We all do this, right? So, with PWA in particular, I really thought they had added the support for this like low level in the system, and I think it was 1709, and then formal support through the store in 1803. So it's been a year, And I thought there was going to be an explosion of web apps on Windows in 2018. And that didn't happen to my knowledge. I mean, the thing is, they're actually not really advertising what web apps are in the store. So one of my goals for Build this year was to talk to those folks. And I talked to Aaron Gustafson at Gustafson, and I'm forgetting names. I'm losing my mind.
Jeff Bertolf.
Yeah, thank you. You know, 18 months ago, and I wanted to talk to those folks again, and I did. And, you know, what they basically told me was a couple things. First of all, there's a lot more web apps in the store than we know about. And they said basically that there are a lot of high-profile names that they are not allowed to discuss because those app makers, those companies, those services are doing this for some kind of competitive advantage, and they don't want their competitors to know what they're doing in some cases. Microsoft is creating a showcase program through their PWA Builder app so that people and companies can promote the apps that they're making as PWAs. And so we'll see that happen this year. And they expect sometime this year that this will become much more of a public process where they'll start discussing it. But the biggest thing about PWAs, and to me the most interesting, ties into this conversation we're about to have about UWP as well and store apps. And that's that there's been a seismic shift at Microsoft with regards to the App Store, which is that when Microsoft went into Windows 8 in particular and then in Windows 10 again, they had this App Store and an app platform based on a mobile app platform like you'd see on iOS or Android. And this thing was designed to be the future of Windows app development. And everything else that came before it, Win32, all the .NET stuff like WPF, WinForms, et cetera, would be deprecated and eventually be left behind as everyone jumped on board this mobile app train. But that never happened. Mm-hmm. And what they learned, and this is for PWAs and specifically, but I would say generally speaking with the store, I think this is true as well. People on Windows and people on the Mac too, by the way, don't think App Store when they want to get apps for their computer. They go to the web and they download them from the web. You know, you go to Firefox.com, you get a browser, you go to Office.com and you get your webs, Office Productivity Suite, whatever it is. People who are on mobile very much think App Store. Mm-hmm. That's been something they've really done a good job of training people on. No one expects to go to the web. In fact, no one thinks you can do that to get an app. You know, they go to the store. And so it's a different kind of behavior. So when Microsoft first supported PWAs, the plan was we're going to support it through the store and we're going to do the opposite of what Google's going to do, which is support it through the browser. But now they're saying, plus they're adopting Google's browser, right? Actually, you know that Google system for doing it through the browser? That works great. We're going to do that now too. They're not just doing it for PWAs, by the way. One of the big shifts that I don't think got enough press this year is that they're going to open up all of the store apps in a way that they can be distributed outside of the store. And this is goes back to that Microsoft always goes to where the customer thing is we were talking about earlier. You know, the store thing just hasn't worked. And it doesn't mean it's going away. I mean, a lot of people take things very literally. I think right ahead of Build, I had written something, is the store on the way out, right? And it doesn't mean someone's going to bring it up behind the barn and shoot it in the head. It just means that it's kind of being de-emphasized. It's not the place that people go to get things. It just hasn't worked out that way. And I think, I said, I think part of it is just the mentality of users on Windows. And instead of, fighting it like they did for, 6 years, they're just embracing it. And so they're going to give developers more options. And you can kind of see how we evolved to it because we talk a lot about this. When the store launched originally, it was modern apps only or what became UWP apps. And it was like, well, we have all these bridges now and you can bring in these other kinds of apps. And it's like, well, they kind of expanded the definition. And Mary Jo talked to Kevin Gallo, and maybe you could speak to this a little bit better than I can.
I will.
But this notion of now it's just Windows apps. And there's two sides to it. One is just the definition of apps explodes into a bunch of different things. But the places that you get the apps is also going to expand past the store.
Exactly. Right. So this was probably one of the most interesting interviews I had at Build because I had never gotten to talk one-on-one to Kevin Gallo before. He is the corporate vice president of Windows Developer Platform. So I just went into the meeting and I said, okay, I have two questions basically. Is UWP dead and is the store dead? That's what I would like to get you on the record saying. And so, because these days at Microsoft, they don't want to say any technology is dead. They don't like to use dead. They don't like to use the word deprecated. They don't like those words anymore. They would prefer instead to say, you know what? We're leveling everything up. We're putting everything on the same level. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, but what does that mean? Like, does it mean it's dead?
It means a rising tide floats all boats.
Right? Yeah, so Kevin Gallo didn't want to be the guy saying UWP is dead. He didn't want to be that guy. But the way he answered my question, the way he answered my question made me feel like, okay, it's not dead, but we realized what our mistakes were. And we're going to try to fix them now. I mean, he actually said to me on the record, arguably, we should not have gone that way when he was talking about creating the schism between UWP and 132, which Microsoft did do. I mean, I feel like when they first announced UWP, it almost was meant to be the gauntlet gets thrown down to developers. And here's where we want you to go. We want you to now write apps or move your apps to this platform off of 132. And so we're just going to say, if you don't do it, you're not going to have your app in the store. And that's where everything is happening. But now, you know, Kevin Gallo was pretty straightforward when I said, what about the store? He said, we're going to let people use the store as a distribution channel if they want. And if they don't want to, they don't have to. That's so different, right? That's completely different than when UWP was first announced.
The anti-Sinofsky way of doing things. The one-way dead-end street that was the store before.
Right.
You know, the problem with the UWP stuff, I'm sorry, just real quick. Yeah. It always seems so immature to me. I have yet to see a UWP app that takes on what I would call the command density of a Microsoft Office application, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
A full feature one, in other words, literally Word done as a UWP.
Yeah, because remember, so originally the Office team was going to make the entire Office suite UWP. That was a stated plan.
You know what they probably found? You know what happened to those guys? It didn't work because it's just not that sophisticated.
The only one that is UWP only is OneNote, right?
Right.
I mean, there isn't another Office app that they took away from 132, right?
Which, by the way, would be better served as a PWA.
So can't you say the same thing about PWAs that you say about UWP? I mean, aren't they?
No, because PWAs run everywhere. They are the opposite of UWP. The problem with UWP was they only ran on Windows 10 or Windows 8 back when they were called something else. And these were operating systems that when they launched had tiny minority usage share. And the broader Windows base could not access them. It's the same conversation we're having right now around Microsoft Edge. They should have launched that browser on Windows 7 and Windows 8 when Windows 10 launched. It should have been something that was updated outside of the operating system. And that they didn't do that was just a mistake of leadership at the time. It was for all the good that came out of Sinofsky leaving and a different team coming in, they still got a couple of things wrong and they continued a couple of things that had started before them that were just wrong. And the store and UWP and Edge are on that list.
Yep. So, back to the whole, why is everybody freaking out about this idea that UWP isn't what it was, whether you want to say dead or whatever. If you think about the
I want to say dead.
It's not alive.
Yeah. It's not quite alive. It's just resting, right?
It's not.
But I think I understand where a lot of the developers are coming from. A lot of the people who are really mad about this are people who did do what Microsoft said, and they went and they built UWP apps, right? And a lot of those people are also people who went with Microsoft and bet on Silverlight. These are people who have been burned, right? And now, if somebody came in and said, hey, you know, you guys did what we said, but that platform's dead, these guys would be like, what? You know, like once burned, twice shy or whatever. Right?
But we should throw these people a bone because this is very emotional for them. And it's kind of like if you go onto Twitter and you say, iPhone sucks. And then, of course, maybe you could explain why, or maybe you can't. It doesn't really matter. But what you've just done is insulted a product that people have invested in. They've spent money on it. They spend time on it. They feel it more personally than some would imagine. I mean, it's a very emotional thing for them. If you have invested in UWP, of course, you don't want to hear this. Of course, you want to, shoot the messenger. As an outsider, I can look at this with a certain clarity that I think someone on the inside cannot. By the way, confirm, Windows UWP is dead, and it's dead, literally dead. And it's not dead kind of dead. It's not, we're all moving forward. It's not, everything else is getting its capabilities and we're all winners. It's not that. It is not that. But I do understand why people would be freaking out over this. And I think the bone we should give them, this is really important, is it something we have talked about before, which is whether it's Silverlight is a good example of this. Yeah, okay, they screwed up Silverlight. They killed it. But that thing was a .NET-based programming environment that is very familiar to people who had been doing WPF before, who had been doing WinForms before, who had just are .NET programmers. Maybe they went to UWP. There's always a path forward. There will be Windows apps. They might be some new thing. They might be some combination of old things that are now being updated to be new things. We don't know exactly what form it's going to take.
Right.
UWP is not going to disappear.
No.
It's not like Windows 11 comes out. You can't run UWPs. Like the apps don't disappear. It's not a dead end street.
No.
It is absolutely an evolution. It's a change. And I don't understand how you can't look at something that's in a positive light. Microsoft is finally doing the right thing.
I know. But you know why I think they can't is because when people hear UWP is dead, they assume that means all the investment they put in it is dead also, right? Raf was talking about this on Twitter, and I put a link into one of the things he said because I was like, yep, that's it. He said, UWP is not an API. It's not a technology. It was a modern app dev walled garden. And that approach is dead. That's right. That's what it is, right?
That's right.
The walled garden thing is what's dead.
Yep. Yep.
And then he said, it did envelop a bunch of existing techs, like 132 APIs. There are some of those in UWP, and those aren't going away. You know, WinRT is not going away. Calm, not going away. Those are all still alive. He's right.
They're making really good decisions on the tech stack these days. Like WinUI is being decoupled from Windows 10 versions. So you'll be able to take the most modern version of the WinUI, which is all the controls and everything, and put it in an app that will run on any supported version of Windows 10, not just the most recent version. That's huge. And it doesn't matter which environment you choose, UWP or WPF, Win32 even, whatever. The other thing, just to get kind of esoteric quick, just real quick, some things are really dead and have no path forward. And some things are dead but have paths forward. Think back to between Win32 and .NET, there was a terrible thing that we're all kind of forgetting about right now called the Microsoft Foundation classes, right? And this was a set of convoluted and terrible C++ wrappers on top of Win32. This was going to be the way forward at one point, right? The idea was that C++ and OOP were the object-oriented programming were the future. Microsoft is going to support this. They came up with the ugliest pig of a product you could possibly imagine. There were far better things than this, including, by the way, the VCL, part of Portland Delphi. Just want to throw that little, I wrote a little book about it. it's just a superior technology. Anyway, but you know, as the world moved forward, I would say from .NET on, and literally .NET Framework 1.0, which, you know, by the way, when it first shipped, had no support for audio, and relied on, you know, you being able to call Win32 APIs. To do certain things. I think Microsoft has done, even though they've gone down paths that were wrong, they have brought forward that style of programming with everything that they've done. And so anyone who has invested time, I would say in anything from .NET on, including UWP, has a healthy future ahead of them as a Microsoft stack developer.
Agree.
Granted, most of this is not going to be on Windows 10 or whatever, right? I mean, the real future of this stuff is IoT and cloud and things that are not necessarily Windows 10 native. But but if that was your investment, if that was your career path, there's no dead end.
Because it's going to be cross-platform now.
Exactly.
It's not going to be a walled garden anymore. And that's
right.
Good.
Well, yeah.
I know.
We didn't talk about this too much, but .NET is cross-platform now.
Yep.
Right. So .NET 5,
because
it's going to come out till next year, is replacing the proprietary .NET framework.
And, is that because of Xamarin? Is that what they're?
Is it because of Xamarin?
Xamarin's part of it, part of the story. But
when I do .NET on a Mac, for instance, is really Xamarin.
I think it is fair to say that the work that Miguel and those folks did on Mono and bringing .NET to, I don't know if it was just Linux or Linux and Mac OS or whatever, was absolutely a trigger for this. Sure. But also just Microsoft's general openness to the rest of the world. I mean, this is just the Microsoft of today. If Microsoft had invented .NET today and not in 2000, 2001, whenever that was, it would absolutely be open source and cross-platform. And now it will be.
Totally. What is .NET? Yep. What is .NET? I mean, if if it's not a Windows framework, then what is .NET?
Well, it is a framework, and it's a runtime environment. Yep.
So it's a framework now that's cross-platform.
Yeah, it's a lot like Java, frankly. I mean, and I was talking to Richard Campbell about this last week or 10 days ago, whenever. I asked, I said, listen, I said, can you give, it's funny you asked that question because I said, I feel like I do understand what .NET is, but he's a .NET expert. I said, can you give an elevator pitch for .NET? He's like, what do you mean? I mean, can you explain to a normal person, like my wife, what this thing is and why it's important and why it's amazing that it's going cross-platform? And he said, yeah. And I said, good. So we'll talk to you sometime. We'll do that.
he didn't get it. So he can, though. That's
good.
But
if you look, if you actually do a search on Google and or Bing, if you would like, what is .NET? You see the same block diagram come up all the time, right? So bottom layer, common language runtime, then there's class libraries, then there's all, each like successive level is a little more proprietary, I would say. Like WinForms,
Go.NET.
Yes, it's a series of tubes. And, you know, at the top, then you see people adding like .NET APIs for the store and Windows UWP apps. So it's a framework. It's a cross, I guess, well, now we can call it a cross-platform.
No, it's a cross-platform framework, yes.
Yeah.
A developer framework for building apps is what they say, a platform.
But it's also a runtime environment. I think that's
Does it replace that old C runtime, C++ runtime that Microsoft distributes, the DLL?
Oh, boy. I mean, it must have its own support libraries.
Must have its own.
Probably. I mean, you could kind of make a case that .NET, as originally envisioned, was much like MFC was, in the sense that we're now giving you a more sophisticated way to write apps using more modern programming languages and programming styles or whatever. I mean, ultimately, on Windows, of course, it was like MFC. It was still running on top of Win32. Win32 is the foundation, well, and then some assembly language stuff, of course, but for everything that happens programmatically in Windows. So.
But they must have decoupled it from that, because now it's cross-platform, right?
Yes. Yeah, of course. Yep. Yeah, and you know, like I said, if they had done .NET today and not
would have been different
back when, it would never have
but
been
But they're talking about it supporting microservices, IoT, cloud, machine learning. Yeah. It's not just desktop. It's not just mobile.
Yeah,
it's
so
everywhere.
Over the years, remember there was something called the .NET Compact Framework, which was the ActiveX of .NET, if you will. The a way of making it much smaller, so that it ran on on less RAM and less hardware resources and so forth. And I'm sure that's been rolled into whatever will become .NET 5, which is just a single platform now for everything essentially.
But I would say about .NET 5, even though the ultimate goal is to try to have one .NET across everything, it never is actually going to happen, right? Like .NET Framework is not going to die. It's still going to stick around. .NET Framework 4.8 is not going to go away.
I mean, people, developers can, of course, continue targeting any version of the .NET Framework further, of course. I mean, it doesn't literally ever go away, but or for some period of time. It will also work differently across platforms, right?
Yeah, it does.
The Windows version will have Windows-specific features that they cannot add to other platforms.
I feel like it's kind of like Visual Studio for the Mac, how that's what Microsoft calls it, even though it's not that. It's actually something from Xamarin that they rebranded.
Xamarin Studio, yeah.
So right up here at the top of the framework, this is 2012. This is old. I should get a newer one. Is this little tiny box, which is UWP apps, everything else you learned is applicable, right? So you're not, it's not like you wasted
your time. What's not in that diagram, if you could show that again real quick,
is
at the bottom is actually Win32, right? And so if you think about this for a second, they have literally deprecated Win32, WPF, and WinForms, which are really really low level in that diagram. Those things are all now first class choices for people that want to write Windows desktop app or Windows, we'll call them Windows apps.
Right. So this is really, this is 4.5, and now that we're at 5.
Right. Well, we're working on 5. It's the modern version of the .NET framework, I think, is 4.8.
Okay.
The version of .NET Core, which is the current open source version, they will complete version 3 in September. And then .NET 5 will take place of both is starting sometime next year.
And here's the language.
Yeah, this makes it very clear. So,
thank you so much. You got your C sharp or your J sharp?
The ones and the zeros that made us clear.
Yeah, that's it. That's what you get to right there at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Guys, I think we should talk about something even less concrete, like the fluid framework.
is there such a thing?
Oh, the fluid framework. It's back, baby.
Well, let's remember there's Fluent, which is the user experience UI layer that they're creating over time. And then this Fluid, which, Leo, you will be delighted to find out is nothing like they described at the show.
Oh, nice. And I had memorized that talk.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. So remember last week on Windows Weekly when we were talking about the build announcements, we said, wow, there's this thing. It sounds almost like Olay, right? Object Linking and Embedding.
It's like, right. It's the end of apps. Compound apps and cross-platform and blah, blah.
Then we get to have some interviews at the show where people who worked at Microsoft told us a little more. And it's so for me, it sounds like what the Fluid framework is going to be, at least initially, is improved co-authoring of documents. So it'll be a lot faster and it will enable people to behave more truly interactively when they're co-editing documents. But the part of it about, and you can take things from documents and embed them across different applications. That sounds like it might happen if co-authoring gets fast enough so that it'll feel like that to you. But I don't think that part is there. I don't think there's a there.
I think it's, yeah. So I think you remember the number. They were saying that there's a response time when you're working collaboratively. What is it?
Right. 50 milliseconds.
No, 50 milliseconds. So I guess the Fluid framework, right, which is the name of this thing, as is currently existing, can achieve this at scale, right? And so I don't know why you'd want 50 people co-editing a document at the same time, but apparently they were allowing that and whatever. And at that level of speed or whatever, or response time. Mm-hmm. And the way he described it was there's something magical that happens at that speed because it becomes truly real time. Whereas today when you do real time together, you know, there's a little weird pause and stuff suddenly appears in little blurts and it's kind of unnatural. And if you're using OneDrive, even doing it not in real time is weird and unnatural as we've discovered. Yeah. But but anyway, I guess the central genius of this thing is that they've figured out truly real time collaboration at scale.
Right.
Which is neat. But a far cry from the thing that got me excited, which was this future where they see what we called sort of an Olay for the web, which I think is really neat and could speak to a future where apps, as we know them today, become very different things.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen this year, though.
No. Microsoft at the end of build brought a bunch of reporters, but neither of us were in this group, to their envisioning center on campus on building 33. And so they showed them these mocked up demos of what they would like Fluid framework to be someday, which made it feel, I think, to many people like, oh, it's here, right? I actually don't think that's there. I feel like this Fluid framework thing from people I talked to came together very quickly. And Microsoft's story is we've been working on this for 3 years and it's really far along. But I think the part that's far along is the co-authoring, the faster co-authoring part, which is great. That's going to be fantastic. But the part about the compound documents and all, I think that's more of a mocked up kind of demo-ware.
It's almost
thing.
Aspirational, would you say?
Yes, I would say that. I would say that. Yeah. Based on people I talked to at Build, it sounds like that makes for a really cool demo and it looks really awesome. Like a thing in the future is here today, but I don't think the here today part is really there.
Yeah. It also, you know, it speaks to a conversation I think we had last week around whether or not Build was boring, right? Which to me is kind of a weird thing to even have to discuss. But when you think that Google and Apple and even Facebook probably at their respective developer conferences have what is essentially a consumer facing press conference on day one.
It was sexy style. Yeah.
Right. Microsoft doesn't really do that. They've dabbled in that in the past, obviously. Notably this year, they did not. I sort of made the case, not sort of, I literally wrote formally that I didn't think that Build was boring. And I thought it was very, very focused on developers. I made that argument I made earlier today about Microsoft, you know, no developer left behind kind of stuff. But, you know, it's really interesting to me. I got to say, at the show, every single person I talked to, and these are people who are analysts or reporters or developers who are at the show, I talked to folks from Microsoft who gave me some kind of interesting insider information about how they view the show. The collective response was like, this show was really kind of boring. And I still don't see it that way. But I guess there was kind of a last minute scramble, like we need some stuff, you know. And I don't know if that was part of the the responsibility behind what happened with that Apollo 11 demo, or why they brought out the fluid. I have a hard time with that.
Fluid.
The fluid framework, maybe earlier than they should have, frankly. Because you know, I think the exciting part of that is not won't be ready maybe ever, but if it is, it won't be till next year or later. I don't know, but it's my favorite Microsoft show. I did not feel that this show was in any way boring or less or whatever than, you know, years past. I thought it was great, but I apparently am in the minority.
Yeah.
Well, you know, from what I've heard from my contacts who work at Microsoft, you know, one of these things that these big shows do for companies is it gives you what they call a forcing function, right? So if you're on a team, right around the time they're starting to plan for Build, they come to your team and they say, hey, what do you have for Build? You know, and so if you've been working on something for a while or it's not quite ready, they may give you a little push and say, you know, we know you don't think that's quite ready, but we need some big bang kind of thing to show at Build. So you're going to be on the stage. So come up with something.
That's what happens,
you know.
Sure.
Remember a couple years ago, they did the whole thing about conversation as a service and the bot framework and bots. I mean, that kind of came together at the very end from what I had heard. Okay. Like it was like they weren't ready for that. But guys, you're on stage. So
I guess that's why it's so valuable to have Mary Jo, because I think that perspective.
No, it does. Because, Microsoft's never going to communicate that. But when you know that, then you go, okay, I can take this with a grain of salt. This was, you know,
but I would also say to people, you know, if you're interested in developer topics, obviously, especially Microsoft Stack stuff, or you want to find out what's going on with the PW stuff that we were talking about, or you're just interested in the future of whatever thing you're interested in at Microsoft Windows or whatever, I would go to the Build site. I would look through the sessions. I would download those videos of the sessions, right? Not the keynote stuff, but the sessions.
Yeah.
Right. And watch them, you know. And this is true of the Google stuff, too. I did that with some Google I.O. Videos. I did it with a bunch from Build. I still have many more to watch. But I think that's where my, you know, now that the show's over, it's passed. I'm still kind of going through some of the information. I don't see this as being much different from years past or any different. I don't know.
I think compared to last year, it felt like they did take developer feedback into consideration, and they actually talked more to Windows developers at this Build than they did last year.
Yeah, and that's a positive. I also feel like the way they structured the keynote was in response to feedback, and that it was better than it was before. Remember, we had to do jumping jacks and stuff a year ago or whatever, right? Remember, it was so long.
Because it went on so long.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not saying it's, you know, the be-all, end-all or whatever, but I thought Build was great.
Good. Yeah, because you have a programmer's heart.
I guess so. Yeah, the dark soul of a programmer.
Well, no, mostly enlarged and cholesterol laden. But other than
it turns out sitting on your butt in front of a computer all day long every day is not super helpful.
No, I'm teasing because I also have a programmer's heart. So it's interesting. So .NET has really a strong reputation as being the way to develop for Windows, especially with Visual Basic. You know, if you're going to say this is a cross-platform, which it is, a cross-platform framework suitable for multiple languages, including a functional language like F-sharp and C-sharp, and that's almost a different pitch. It fits the new Microsoft. I mean, they own GitHub, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Do you think that they're changing how they talk about .NET?
Yes and no. I mean, it just being cross-platform.
I feel like the past few years they've been pushing the idea that we are a cross-platform development shop because of .NET. I feel like that's been a theme for the past few years.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's how I would say this. We keep talking about how Microsoft is trying to go where the customers are. There are two sides to Microsoft when it comes to developers. And I don't mean, you know, Windows versus cloud. I mean, just in kind of the approaches that they take. You can see one approach in the new stuff, Visual Studio Code, which runs on every platform and is aimed at people who are not in the Microsoft stack. You're writing in JavaScript typically, or in some kind of a mobile, like a Flutter and Dart, you know, for mobile development. It's literally not Microsoft stack, but it's very open to the world. And it's been adopted like very broadly. Like even the former kind of anti-Microsoft crowd who would run Linux has acknowledged like this thing's actually pretty amazing. But for the Microsoft stack guys, for the no developer left behind stuff I was talking about earlier, the approach there is, well, look, we have .NET Core, which is going to become .NET 5. We have ASP.NET Core. We have TypeScript, right? Which is, you know, Anders Heilsberg's latest language. The guy who did Turbo Pascal, Delphi, .NET, C-sharp rather, and now has created his take on JavaScript, right? And so for the people that have grown up in that world and want to continue with the same style of programming, the same type of languages and APIs and so forth, there's a way forward for them as well if they want to go into that web app world. Obviously, on the mobile app side, they're still talking about Xamarin, which is a C-sharp type thing where you create mobile apps. So they're really – it's the same thing over and over again. They're supporting both, and they're giving their legacy developers, the people who've been around for a long time, a way forward. And they're looking at the developer base that – frankly, was never kind of Microsoft-focused, and they're giving them options as well. That's what the whole Windows subsystem for Linux is about, is giving them options. They're trying to make Windows the best place to be if you're a developer, no matter what you care about or what you're doing.
Yeah, but that's the language that they've kind of deprecated for the rest of the world. Microsoft wants to be everywhere our customers are, but the best experience will be on Windows. That's gone.
No, but... Right. Just the first half of that is the case now.
Yeah. So why say that for developers, too? I mean, why not just say, hey, we don't care. Use whatever you...
Well, I think they are actually saying that, right? Yeah. I think when Microsoft comes out with something like Visual Studio Code that literally becomes a first-class environment for JavaScript or Flutter and Dart or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're still supporting all those guys who came up through Win32, MFC maybe, all the .NET stuff, the WPFs, the WinForms, et cetera, Silverlight, whatever it is. You have .NET, ASP.NET Core, you have TypeScript, you have Visual Studio, go nuts. We have stuff for you too. You could create a PWA using ASP.NET Core if you wanted to.
Right.
ASP.NET Core, yes. Or you could just, you know, use JavaScript like everyone else in the world. But the point is they're giving you the option.
Yeah.
And they're literally, we'll support everything. We're just going to support everything. I think it's smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
I think they have to do it. I don't think it's an option anymore not to do that. Because, you know, we said at the start of the show, 1.5 billion Windows machines out there, but that's not the future. The growth is all in mobile platforms. And so they have to find a way to keep a hand in this.
Yeah. And, they have a good presence in mobile apps. They have a good presence in development, regardless of where you want to be, too. I mean, the one thing they can't do much about right now is the iOS development requires a Mac and requires Xcode. Yeah. That's just a lock-in thing that Apple does. But then again, you could do Flutter, which is a Google, I don't know if the API is right, a Google framework, I guess. You know, it uses the Dart programming language. You still need a Mac somewhere in the chain if you're going to publish to the store, but that's true of Xamarin as well. So they're supporting, you know, they have ways forward if that's what you want.
Because I also feel like a lot of developers are going to say, well, this is all well and good, but I'm going to do JavaScript and
but you know what, those people maybe will use Visual Studio Code.
They sure will. It's very nice. I like it.
I mean, if the thing that really sells Visual Studio Code is anyone who's ever used Android Studio or IntelliJ or whatever. I mean, Visual Studio Code is like a breath of fresh air.
Nice. Yeah. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about stuff.
well more stuff.
You know, I've given up on teasing people. There's no point in teasing people. You people know if you want it, it'll be there. Well, conversion transcription in the cloud with virtual mic arrays. Stay tuned. But first, a word from Capterra. If you are using old software, and I know a lot of you are still, you know, at work, you're still forced to use Windows XP or Internet Explorer 8 because that's the way that line of business program works. And the kid who wrote it graduated from high school, and we don't know where he went, so we're stuck with it. Or you could go to Capterra.com and find modern software for almost any area of business. 700 specific categories. We're looking at new CRM programs. First place we go, Capterra. IT project management, e-commerce, link management tools, web conferencing, even very specific stuff like veterinary practice management, yoga studio management. It's all at Capterra. It's the best, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. The way it works, you go to Capterra, you pick your category, you pick your, you know, what you're looking for, drill right down to that, you know, I want yoga studio software. And then even better, there's filters. It's got to do this, it's got to do that. Has to be online, has to be on-prem. You tell it what you want, narrow it down even farther. You can create a comparison table so you can see side by side. And then the best part is Capterra has over 875,000 reviews from real users of those products. There's a 1,000 new reviews every single day. So you're really going to be able to get a sense of what people who use the product think, which is fantastic. You're not going to see professional reviewers looking at the latest yoga studio management. It's not going to be, you know, on extreme tech. But honestly, wouldn't you rather see what a yoga studio owner says about the product? I don't mean to focus on yoga studios. It's a lot of different kinds of things. We're looking, as I said, at CRM. And it's really nice to be able to compare head-to-head. You can even say, I only want to see 5-star reviews, you know, subjects, the best of the best. Filter by users, deployment, features. They'll even show you a list of related categories for future options. It is so cool. No matter what kind of software you need for your business, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. And once you find it, do us a favor, leave a review, share your knowledge. That's what makes Capterra better and better. And again, I want to emphasize, this is all free. Free, not freemium, not they're going to charge you later, nothing, free. Check out Capterra's website, Capterra, C-A-P-T-E-R-R-A, Capterra.com/windows. Millions of people use Capterra every single month. You should. Capterra.com/windows. So now when the boss comes to you and says, no, you've got to use IE8. And you, by the way, you're listening to this show, you know better. You can say, boss, look what I found. This is modern. This is new. This is awesome. Capterra.com/windows. Capterra. Software selection simplified. None simpler than Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley are. Windows Weekly.
Wait a minute.
Hey, I didn't mean to come out right.
Hey, was that a backhanded compliment?
It was a backhanded insult.
It was just a backhand, really.
It was a backhand.
Slap to the back of the head. Sorry, I was joking. I was teasing. I did leave out this conversation transcription in the cloud with virtual mic arrays, which was initially part of the overall thing.
Build stuff.
Did you want to mention anything about that?
Yeah. So I don't think we talked a lot about this last week, but during the Satya Nadella keynote, I missed this whole part of this demo, but Microsoft was showing this idea of automatic transcriptions for conversation. We saw
cool.
that.
And they had 8 windows open with 8 different languages, and that was really cool. Yep. Yeah.
And they had that weird triangular microphone that they built to show what conferencing systems of the future could do in terms of recognizing speakers and making sure the right comments go with the right speakers and all that. That was cool. The part I missed, they pulled that thing away and still all this transcription stuff was happening. And somebody said to me, did you see when they did that? And I said, yeah, but it didn't really occur to me. So you know how they're doing this?
No.
They're doing a virtual array of microphones in the cloud. And the microphones they're using are on your laptop and your phone. So if you're sitting in a meeting and you just have your laptop there and people have their phones there, it'll use those microphones and kind of beam it up to the cloud and have all the processing happen in the cloud instead of you having to have this custom built microphone array on the desk in the conference room.
What?
I know.
So that's why they got rid of the witches. That gonna... witch's hat disappeared.
Yes, when the witch's hat disappeared, that weird microphone thing, suddenly this was happening in the cloud. And they wanted, I guess they thought everybody would notice that.
Well, it's obvious, the witch's hat disappeared. Oh.
Right. So that thing, that idea of using virtual microphones in the cloud has a code name, and it's called Project Denmark. And a few Danes have said to me on Twitter, why is it called Denmark? And I said, I don't know. But
because there's something rotten in Denmark.
No. Something good in Denmark. Yeah, so that was just one other little tidbit from Build that I thought was kind of cool. Yeah. And that's still like a research project. You know, this is another one.
They really should have blinked the screen or so somebody like unplugged the Ethernet. They needed to do something there.
Movies always have the dub moment, as I call it, which is the callback, right? Yeah. Where they flash back to remember when this used to be here and then we took it away.
You get Joe from IT crawling on his hands and knees and unplugging the Ethernet. You know, and you do a close-up.
Giggling like a little girl. Yeah.
Yeah, you have somebody go, hey, did you guys notice we took the microphone away? Are you wondering how that's happening?
No one said that.
No one said that.
You're just violating our privacy and using our microphones without acknowledging.
Dummy that I am, that they left the hat on the table by accident.
Right, they were just cleaning it up. And then, craft services came.
We weren't supposed to tell anybody about that. And they cleaned it up. It was like the coffee cup in the Game of Thrones. They just edited it out.
It's supposed to be upside down. It's a trash basket.
Nope. We were supposed to all get it and be like, ooh and ah. But I bet 90% of the audience or more did not.
They will never overestimate their audience again.
No. Learned. So that's cool.
That is cool.
Virtual mic arrays.
Exactly.
And by virtual, we mean literal, since obviously there are microphones involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah, but they're virtually involved.
Unless they're using microphones up in the cloud that have like crazy, you know, NSA-style range.
That would be amazing, but no, I don't think they're doing that. No.
Okay, that was the last Build. Let's move into the future now, which was March 2019.
Exactly. Exactly.
The future happened in March 1903.
This is the problem with being in the tech industry, right? We're all enough on the spectrum that this bothers us.
Yes, you know, that's right.
We know that 1903 stands for March.
Excuse me, but we know that May is not March.
This
is 05. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yeah,
it's unbelievable. No, by the way, I want to be clear. I'm not making fun of other people. I'm making fun of myself.
No, we are.
This bothers me.
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
So what's the story, Morning Glory?
Where is it? Where is 1903? Everyone wants to know the thing called the May update. Because
when did they promise
it's now
this?
May
15th. Do you remember?
Yeah, they said late May.
They did say late May. Okay.
Yep. Which means it's going to be in the next 2 weeks sometime.
Here's how late it is. They have shipped two quality updates for this operating system, which they have never deployed to anybody.
But you know what? Doesn't that happen every time? Like they pick something to be the RTM, and then they just keep doing updates for it.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Don't they?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they do. Sure.
Yeah. So the only people so far who are not insiders who have 1903 are people who got it from MSDN. It hasn't been pushed out to any other channels so far.
I'm positive, and I mean 100% positive, that the reason this thing went out to MSDN is because someone didn't get the memo. We are literally doing, I'm not kidding, we are doing,
I kind of feel like that
time.
Too. I do, yeah, too.
And then they have to make this blog post where they're like, you know, we wanted to release it early so developers could, you know, make apps for the new version of Windows, and then they could put their apps in the store. Right away, we're going to accept them immediately, even though no one is running this version of Windows. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I know. But it was weird. And it kind of threw everybody off, because I don't know if you've had this on Twitter, but I keep getting people saying, well, I just got 1903. And I'm like, yeah, you're in the Insider program, right?
Yeah.
So that's how you got it. Because insiders
actually,
can get it.
Right. Somebody said, oh, you know, they just released it to release preview.
Yeah.
Sometime in the past 24, 36 hours. Yeah, they did that like a month ago.
A while ago. Right.
You know? Yeah.
So there's no word from anybody. It's just it's a mystery. No. It's just
late mystery. May.
Any day. So as of tomorrow, it's late May. And, you know, using Microsoft's new calendar, I would say sometime into June could be considered late May. like early June is late May. It could come out anytime.
Anytime.
But I think the bigger question is, where is 19H2?
Right. And what is 19H2?
Right. Yep. So normally, what if you were a Fast Ring insider, you would be testing 19H2 by now.
Right.
But Microsoft still has yet to put out any 19H2 builds to anybody in any ring. So my guess, I don't know if this is right, but I know WSL 2.0 is supposed to start testing in June. So I'm thinking maybe in June they'll start talking about 19H2 because they are not skipping 19H2. I've seen so many people speculate this. They're not. It is going to happen. It's going to be out this year, sometime late this year. October,
they
November.
Mentioned June for several things. I think Terminal might have fallen into that, a couple of other things. And every time I saw that, I thought this must be 19H2.
Yeah. But it's not. So, and both Paul and I, Paul and I, I'm going to speak for you here, believe that 19H2 is going to be a small / incremental update. I've heard from a couple people now, it may not even contain any required new features, that everything if that is a quote new feature that's in 19H2 might be able to be turned off or will ship with it off by default. So the idea, I think, is 19H2 is almost like a service pack, even though they don't use that terminology anymore. And that is by design because the second half of the year release is the one that Microsoft supports longer. It supports it for 30 months instead of 18 months. And so if you're an IT pro, that's the one you typically would like to get on your machines if you're taking these updates. And you don't want all these new features in it. Like you want to be able to control that more. And I think that's why they're doing this the way they are. And will Fast Ring even get to test 19H2 or will it be slow and release preview ring only?
That's my guess.
Me too.
That's my guess. That's my guess. Yeah.
Right.
So you have spoken for me accurately.
Good. Paraphrase that well.
Well, next time, just move your lips when she's talking. We'll know.
Yeah. Just she's got strings behind me. Yeah. I agree with all of that.
Windows H1 Service Pack 2. Windows Service. I don't know.
Don't call R2. It a service pack. Just like you can't say RTM, you can't say service pack anymore either. No.
It's
allowed.
A 19H1 R2.
But aren't they bringing back the Windows what was it they called it, the toys, the fun stuff,
Power Toys? That's an app pick for later, Leo. Don't
okay shh shh shh. Don't call them Power Toys. Shh.
Yes.
Sorry. I should look at the bottom of the rundown before I look at the top of the rundown.
No, it's
Welcome to Zombie Load, new Intel flaw.
Remember all the fun we had last year with Spectre and Meltdown?
They're back, baby!
And it's like most sequels, a bigger body count this time, you know?
Yeah.
Zombie Load. We talked about yesterday on Security Now. Apple patched yesterday, I think Monday. The weird thing is, Steve said Intel's known about this for a year.
By the way, I just want to be really clear about this. Intel is the best because they did this with Spectre Meltdown, right? There was a group of security researchers that came to Intel, I think a month ago.
In 1994.
We have this blockbuster thing to tell you. You're not going to believe this. They're like, oh, yeah, we know.
We've known since 94.
Yeah, we know.
And now, so Zombie Load, same thing. They knew. Didn't tell anyone. Yeah. Didn't, most importantly, tell Microsoft or Apple. Or anybody who uses Intel chips
or
Google. And then, so when it did come out, everybody had a scramble. Now, do we know, because then the other thing, and it seems, I don't know if it's related or not, but I saw this morning that there is a patch for Windows XP that everybody who uses XP now needs to go to the network updates and download because it's not automatic, of course.
Right.
No, this is not related to that.
You don't think that's not a zombie loop fix? Okay.
No, so this is some other quote wormable flaw that they have discovered.
Oh, it's an RDS flaw. That's right. Yes.
RDS. Yep. Yes. Remote Desktop Services, which is terminal services, which means it's in XP, Windows Server 2003, Windows 7.
It's been there for 30 years.
It's like the gift that keeps on giving.
Yep. And so, they put out a patch yesterday for XP and Server 2003, neither of which are supported by Microsoft anymore. Which, of course, creates yet again the whole cycle of, so why did we buy security patches? And why do we even move off XP? They're going to keep patching it for everyone anyway.
Well, this is pretty critical.
It is. Yeah. No, and when people say that, I'm like, so come on.
Yeah. This one, in fact, let's not berate Microsoft. Let's thank them.
This is good. I think it's good they did
There's
this.
A lot of people using XP. Of course, most of those people aren't even aware of it and will not update.
Right. Right. You have to go, like you said, you have to go get it. You're not going to just get the patch.
Be a patch seeker, not a patch leaker.
Oh, no. Seekers? We're going to go seekers.
You must seek the patch. Actually, you can't just go to Windows Update and say, is there an update? You actually have to go to the Update Center and download
it. What does Windows Update do now in Windows XP? Does it make a laughing sound? Is it like that?
No.
It probably gives you a nag notification. Like, I'm sure it does. Why are you still running this?
Does anybody have an XP machine that's on the net and get in the chat room? Can you run it?
And if so, seriously, what is wrong with you? What are you doing?
That's the other set of messages that came out yesterday when I wrote about the patch for XP and Server 2003. People were like, why are people still running those operating systems?
I'm
like,
there's lots of reasons. I mean, Gibson ran it for a long time. You know, it's I like how it looks.
I like how it looks. Wow.
It looks awesome.
By the way, if you like how it looks, you know, go visit stardock.com and figure it out. I mean,
you could get that little special program they have to make it look like what you want.
It does cost $90 to get Windows 10. Maybe they just don't want to spend money.
Oh, there's so many reasons. So many.
I think a lot of people just don't know or care. You know, it's the same people who have Commodore 64s in the closet.
I know how to secure my machine, right? I don't need patches. I know what not to do to get infected by malware.
I think the word went out.
I don't think you do.
I think the word went out. I think that it was widely explained you shouldn't be using XP. I don't think this is...
Yeah. Maybe there's some older people. No one can call me ignorance in this.
Well, maybe they can. If you're surfing.
I still see it. Don't you guys sometimes still see it? Like if you're in.
In airports and stuff. Yeah, all the time.
Older dentist office software. God,
Well, that
and
actually.
You see it and you're like.
there's XP on X-ray machines that you can't upgrade. Yeah. So, I mean, there's definitely, medical hardware and stuff running XP.
Yeah.
So the solution there is you got to air gap it and I don't know what you do. Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of a surprise in Patch Tuesday yesterday. Surprise.
And we should underscore Server 2003 too.
Yes, Server 2003. Right.
Yep.
And also 2008 and 2008R2, I believe, as well.
That's right.
Which
That's
right. are not 2008R2 isn't yet out of support. I don't think, or it will be soon, but not yet. And Windows 7.
Does this affect RDS on modern versions of Windows 2? In other words, it's just these older
versions.
Not
on 8 or 10. Oh, okay. Those are okay.
Okay, so there's not.
So everyone's got to upgrade to 8. Let's go, guys.
Let's go, everybody.
8.1, 10, and the any server starting with 2016 or newer, you're okay.
How about Windows Phone? Does it Windows Phone?
Might.
Too soon. What about Zune?
My Kin phone is throwing up an RDS error. Do you guys know anything about that?
There are people in our audience who are IT professionals. They are trained. Mm-hmm. They are trained to handle emergencies like this. They are trained when they go into a dentist's office and they see Windows XP to say, I can fix that. They are people who have learned their skills from IT Pro TV, our sponsors. We love IT Pro TV. Now, for 5 years, they've been teaching people the skills they need to get the certs they want to get the job that will make their life better and keep that job and get a better job or get a raise. IT Pro TV is IT training from experienced IT professionals who happen to be really good on camera, really engaging. It's comprehensive training. You can look at it in your browser. You can watch on your phone. They have apps for iOS and Android. Those apps can Chromecast your big screen TV, but why even bother with that? Because they also have Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV. You can watch it anywhere. Listen to it on the way to work. Have it in a little window on your computer at work. And this whole time, almost by osmosis, you're learning, you're gaining the skills you need. There, and this is a great time to join IT Pro TV if you're not already a member, and I know many of you are, but if you're not already doing it, and again, it's for people who want to get into IT, but also IT professionals. They just they just launched a course. Oh, I really want to take it, and I forgot what it was. I saw it this morning, and I said, oh, I'm taking that. You know, things like how to use Wireshark, stuff like that. Stuff that everybody would really want to take and want to know. Standard membership, which is the videos. And they do new videos. They have five studios. They do at least three of them at a time are running all day, Monday through Friday. So they're creating thousands of hours of new content. They have thousands of hours on demand. They're always up to date, which is really nice. That complete access to that entire studio, $28.50 a month. It's nothing. Less than one IT training book, you know. They have a premium membership, which includes, of course, all the on-demand video, all the live video, but also practice tests so you can take the exam before you take the exam. That's great if you're about to, you know, go out there and get that cert. Really good way to get some confidence and understand what you don't know. They even have, like, study groups for different areas, for different questions. There's lots of ways to learn. You also get labs, which are great. Any HTML5 browser, and you can configure, set up, a Windows network, you got Windows server, Windows clients, the whole thing. And if it's not working, you just close the tab. You go, I broke it. That's what I do. That is normally $42 a month, but I am going to give you an even better deal. IT Pro TV is still honoring our Twit special, 30% off for Twit listeners. And that's forever, for the life, as long as you stay active, that's forever. So that means less than $20 a month for the standard membership, less than $200 a year. Come on. If you want to get the premium membership, less than $300 a year. For your education, you could double your income. Less than a dollar a day for a premium membership. I'm sure you spend more than that on a cup of coffee. IT Pro TV. I want you to check them out. They're CompTIA's official video training partner. So if you want to get that A+ or Network Plus or Security Plus cert, that's the place to go. They have 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. But all the certs, everything, MCSE, Cisco, everything. Go. And as I said, there's classes and stuff that you might just want to learn just because it's fascinating. Visit go.itpro.tv, go.itpro.tv/windows. And if you want that 30% off deal, the code is WW30. 30% off for the life of your active subscription. Go.itpro.tv/windows. Offer code WW30. IT Pro TV. Flexible training. Binge-worthy content. Life-changing results. And great people, too. IT Pro TV. Back to Paul and Mary Jo Foley.
Hey, by the way, in keeping with our previous conversation,
yes,
Microsoft just announced something called the Microsoft Web Template Studio, which is a cross-platform extension for Visual Studio Code aimed at creating full-stack web applications.
Nice.
It's open source, and it was created by Microsoft interns, by Microsoft Garage.
So go to your package manager and search for, what's it called again?
What is it called again? It's called, sorry, I scroll down, Microsoft Web Template Studio.
Web Template Studio. Neat. I'm going to install that. I love VS Code.
Yeah,
I really do. It is nice. Did you see given this huge success of the Galaxy Fold folding phone, now Lenovo wants to get in the act?
Listen, pre-announcing something you're never going to release is just what we're doing these days.
So this is a folding computer from Lenovo. Wow. Wow. Yeah.
And this won't
come. But they're not the only ones.
The Galaxy. Oh, no, of course not. I think they announced it to be first.
Yeah.
Kind of like Samsung. Right.
But still, Microsoft Andromeda is dead. Still dead, yes.
It is, but Microsoft Centaurus, which
What's
we
that?
Think is a dual, it's a foldable PC. I know. We think that still is something they're contemplating releasing. But, you know, my question on this, again, just like Andromeda, why?
Yeah.
Like, what does this get you that you can't do with something like, say, Courier, right? Say you have a dual screen foldable.
Yeah, that's not a folding screen. It's just two, it's like a book with two pages.
Right.
Yeah.
So I actually think this makes a little bit of sense in the same sense that the Galaxy Fold and folding phones can make sense, which is that you can use it like a single screen device.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you can open it up and get a bigger screen. So it's, while it's open, you technically are getting double the screen real estate potentially.
Right.
In a device that's a normal size laptop.
Yeah, it's a 13-inch screen when it's open.
Right.
And it's very portable.
I mean, so if you have a dual screen laptop that just folds with a hinge, right? And if Microsoft does something to the UI.
A bezel in the middle.
Right.
Yeah, but instead Lenovo, you get a crunchy fold in that Lenovo thing.
I don't think we're really there yet.
Yeah. No, you're right. But I feel like the market's like clearly heading in this direction, and someone's going to get it right eventually. Lenovo has experimented with things a little bit like this, right? Like the little yoga device that they had like a, I don't know if it was e-ink or some kind of a, you know, the keyboard wasn't real. It was kind of a virtual.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was keyboard. An e-ink. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it was e-ink.
Well, I don't know. I think it's just, you know, that's a sign of a vital industry where they're
people are trying things.
Throwing stuff against the wall.
Well, and this clearly speaks to the part of the market that is making money for these companies, right? The premium part of the PC market. You know, we'll see. HP announced a dual-screen gaming laptop, which isn't what it sounds like, right? So there's a smaller 6-inch screen above the keyboard on the keyboard deck. And the theory there is that you might use that to, you know, watch, you know, to stream and handle that kind of stuff while you're playing the game on the big screen, or using it to watch YouTube videos about how you get past a hard part of the game or whatever. Was it Microsoft? No, it must have been Google. Yeah, no, Google for their Stadia service was talking about, I think, having a dedicated button on the controller that would go to YouTube or whatever. The idea being that a lot of us do that. You play a game and you're like, I can't get past this part. I have to Google it. You know, you can do it all in the same device. And it's like, okay. I mean, everyone has a phone, you know, or a second screen. It's not really that big of a deal.
Everyone's looking for a gimmick that is going to be why you would still buy a laptop or a PC. Right?
And it's even more dramatic in the phone segment because nobody's buying phones.
But because a phone is a purely multi-touch device,
being able to put something
in your pocket, it's a phone.
Yeah.
And if you're doing like navigation or you're in a hotel and watching a movie or a plane or whatever, and you can unfold it and have that bigger display, there's some advantage to that. It's not a must-have for every single person, but it's also not a complete gimmick. I mean, it seems useful. That could be a device that truly eliminates the need to have two devices for many people. I don't know. Like I would. That said, I would not normally watch a movie on my phone if I was on a plane.
They're doing the innovation in the wrong area. They really need to work on user input devices because the keyboard is really the big problem here.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you can't make that much smaller.
Yeah. I think that's why there's all the speech work, right?
Yeah.
People really seem to think speech could be a true input form and not just a one off. It's not there yet.
Yeah. The only people who think that have never tried it because even as just like the transcription stuff, you know, I think I've mentioned this before. I always thought my future as a writer would be me speaking to the computer like I was in Star Trek.
No.
And it's really kind of tedious and inefficient.
Exactly. It's tedious. That's part of the problem is nobody wants to do it. Yeah, you could do it, maybe.
It sounds like it would be great until you do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Incidentally, Lawn Dog took his life into his hands and plugged his XP computer into the network.
Nice.
And Windows Update doesn't really do anything on XP. It goes to checking updates and just sits there. It's been checking updates for 10 minutes now. It's looking. It's lonely. It says, it's like, is there a server out there? Anyone? Talk to me.
Did he download the update? You know, from the web or whatever.
Well, now, Lawndog, as long as you're online, you might as well download that update and install it. So you go, I think, as I remember, you're looking at Windows Updates on the left. There's like network updates or something like that. Catalog. Maybe. Oh, that's where it is. It's the Windows Update Catalog. Oh,
you think that's where it is?
Yeah, it is. You click that button and you'll go to the catalog. Okay. And then you can search for it, find it. You have to download it like any like a savage.
If I remember the Windows Catalog correctly, they haven't updated that thing since 2001 either. It's going to have a nice old-fashioned looking UI.
Classic.
Yeah, classic. Exactly.
Somebody said, yep. Hello, it's me. Is it Windows Update you're looking for?
Oh, my God,
for?
Someone visit. Oh, no, don't go away. Right, it's like the robot from Portal or whatever.
Maybe Clippy will come out. Clippy will poke his little head out.
Hey, are you looking for, looks like you're looking for a Windows Update.
Dog. That was always the worst part of it. The little search dog thing.
Oh, yeah, the rover guy.
Search rover.
So you'd say, no, I don't want this thing anymore. And then you had to sit there and watch an animation. Well, it walked away. It was
into the distance. He looked like, all sad.
No.
Why don't you? I'm not shooting old Yeller here. I just want you know. Like,
oh God!
It's just rife with this kind of stuff.
As long as we're on Lenovo, there's a new line of ThinkBooks. I'm a ThinkPad fan. I love the ThinkPads. I buy ThinkPads.
What's the point?
What's the ThinkBook?
I can't answer that, but according to, well, I don't quite understand it. You know, ThinkPad itself, you know, Lenovo has different PC lines, right? Including ThinkPad and just Lenovo products
like
and so forth.
The Yoga 630, which is really good. And
yep. But within the ThinkPad line, they have, well, various product lines inside of that. And they've had versions for small and medium-sized businesses, but now they're going to a new brand for them, and it's called ThinkBook.
Built for business, but designed for you.
Yeah, and if I understand it, I think the point of this is that they're gray. I don't quite understand.
Who says work isn't fun? That's one of their taglines.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. I've not seen one yet. I mean, obviously it has what I would call like a Lenovo-style keyboard, which is great. 13 and 14 inch versions.
It's an aluminum ultrabook.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
That's it.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yeah.
So they're just using book because MacBook. Is that why? It's nothing to do with books.
You know, it is. I have to say, it looks a lot like a MacBook. I think there is an opportunity for Apple's just fumbled this laptop thing so badly.
Yeah. We heard you wanted a MacBook with a nice keyboard.
Right. We call it the ThinkBook.
It's a think book. Think.
Different
think.
Book.
Yeah, just think.
Just use your head. 729 starting point.
Yep. Just like a Mac.
Look at the size of the bezel. It's a 1080p display. It's 13 inches. They call it a narrow bezel FHD display with Dolby Vision. Harman narrow speakers, bezel. Narrow bezels. Not there's a bezel.
At the bottom, it ain't.
It is a pretty wide bezel at the bottom.
That's what happens when you have a 16:9 screen. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I
don't make fun of that. I like those.
I like 3:2. I really do.
Mary Jo, why?
I don't.
It's perfect for Notepad. I would think. are you watching movies? Maybe that's it. She doesn't have a TV.
No. No, I do have a TV now.
Oh, she doesn't have a TV now.
Have you plugged it in yet?
Yeah, even have watched it a couple times.
Wow. Live dangerously, girl.
I know.
Woo.
Life has changed.
Life has changed. You got 72 episodes of Game of Thrones to catch up on.
I've still never seen Game
like
of Thrones.
Show with, was it My Girl or whatever, where she spins in the streets of New York?
That girl.
Mary Tyler Moore?
Yeah. No. Wow. Marlo Thomas.
Thank you.
That girl.
That girl.
And then there was Mary Tyler Moore.
Now you've got your big new apartment, and you're seizing control of the city.
Tell the truth, Mary Jo. When you moved to New York, you really were thinking Mary Tyler Moore.
I was. I love that show, you guys.
She turned the world on with a smile.
Yep.
Wasn't she a reporter, too?
Lou Grant was her boss.
Yeah.
You had a bottle of whiskey in the drawer.
Exactly, like the old school journalist.
Can I be your Rhoda?
I have a bottle of whiskey in the drawer. What are you talking about?
See?
Rhoda was your Rhoda, right?
Can I be your Rhoda?
I think that was that show.
Say again? Yeah. Ed Asner was Lou
Ed
Grant.
Asner, yeah.
He says, yep. He says, Mary, you got spunk. I hate
Ted.
Spunk.
Actually, I would probably be your Ted.
Hello, Mary. Hello, Mary Jo. Yeah. No, I'm your Ted Baxter.
Sadly, I would.
I am your Ted Baxter. Yeah. I want to be your Roto. I got to write that down. Definitely the show title. Definitely. So we kind of started talking about Apple's loss in the Supreme Court this week. Now,
yeah,
it just as to be clear, it really comes down to the 1977 Illinois brick ruling.
Yeah, right. But by the way, to be fair, that is an incredibly recent ruling when you compare it to other like antitrust related precedents, right. You know, the Sherman Act and so forth.
The theory is, and I think it's a good theory, you don't want to put a company in double jeopardy. You don't want them to be sued from two different directions. So the fear is that Apple would be sued both by consumers and by developers.
You know what? They deserve to be.
Well, and maybe they do. I mean, everybody agrees the App Store is a monopoly. I mean, that's obvious.
I meant to ask Mary Jo about this before the show, and I forgot, and so I'll just ask now. I seem to recall a legal case. And I thought it was Microsoft, but maybe it was a different company. But what it boiled down to it was. It was Microsoft because I just remembered what it was. Microsoft doesn't sell Windows to users. PC makers sell Windows with their PCs to users. Mm-hmm. So if you have a problem with Windows and you got it on a new PC, you couldn't sue Microsoft. You had to go after the PC maker.
Right.
Yeah. And that's
you had to go for the support as well. I mean, in a more practical vein.
Right. But that's the basic theory here, right? Except for one thing. You're buying an Apple device using an Apple store that Apple created and Apple demands is the only way you can get apps. And that's the reason why I think you should be able to sue Apple for an app that you got in the store that was overpriced.
Brett Kavanaugh agrees with you, Paul.
I know. Yeah. Well, him and I are right on the same page with everything.
Same page. That's so it was a 5-4 decision.
He likes beer.
He likes beer. Paul likes beer. Kavanaugh did write the opinion. The point is that consumers do have standing. Now, that just means that the class action lawsuit can go ahead. It doesn't mean the suit is resolved. And as many have pointed out, Apple will have some tweaks it could make to the store to try to avoid liability. One of which, and that's why I brought it up during the progressive web app thing. One would be, of course, to cut their 30% down to zero for certain circumstances. But I think the better thing would be, well, let's eliminate the monopoly and make sure that we support progressive web apps because then anybody could put an app on an iPhone without Apple's involvement.
That's essentially what Microsoft is doing, right, across the stack.
Yep.
The idea is that the store will not be the only way that you can get apps.
It eliminates the monopoly, and the whole thing goes away.
I don't see Apple doing that. I could see them reducing the commission, as the Supreme Court called it, the VIG, as I would call it. the onerous part of the Apple thing to me is that, look, Apple didn't invent app stores. They did create a thing where they have up to a 30% fee on in-store.
And they have the unique lockdown in the app store. No one else says you have to get all your apps from the app store. That's Apple.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's true.
That's if Amazon said you can only read books on a Kindle, you know, or you can only get Kindle books from us. Well, actually, that is the case. No, that isn't. You could put any book on a Kindle.
You can
sideload.
Okay, but
and on Android, there's a switch where you say, no, I want to get it from somewhere else. And Google says, no,
but
be careful.
That doesn't mean every app you want to get is out there. I mean, there are a lot of apps in the Play Store that probably are not available otherwise.
Yeah, right.
But that's up to the developers.
But that's the point. If the developer has a choice, and for instance, Netflix, which says you can't subscribe to Netflix on Apple anymore because they take 30%. That's rent seeking, clearly, right? They did nothing
or app
to earn
services that never offered it, like Audible and Amazon.
Amazon won't let you buy Kindle books.
Spotify is actually asked the EU to investigate Apple for this very purpose, because Apple in some cases has apps and services that compete with third parties.
Right.
So they're not beholden to this 30% fee. You know, they're at a natural advantage over companies that do have to pay that fee.
I'm hoping this puts pressure on Apple to support PWA fully. Then they can go to the court and say, look, you know, if you don't like it,
so
there's a way to get on the iPhone without our help.
There are two major issues here. I think that there's a natural thing occurring in the marketplace where the commission is coming down. We see that in the Microsoft store, they dramatically lowered their commission. The Epic Store is bringing this notion to gaming. I think there's a natural market force that will occur, and this will certainly expedite it, where maybe the fee comes down. What if it was 10%? Would we be complaining if it was 10%? I don't see Apple completely opening it up so that anyone can put apps from anywhere on the phone. That's not Apple. I can't imagine that's what they're going to do. But, you know, the bigger issue for me, and this has always been the issue, is that ongoing 30 or 15% fee that they apply. So if you subscribe to the New York Times through the App Store, if you subscribe to Spotify back in the day through the App Store or through Netflix before they changed it, Apple would get 30% for the first year every single time that user made a monthly subscription fee. Yeah. And then I think from year two on, it's like 15%. That's insanity. I mean, that is a crazy onerous thing to, you know, I don't remember the number for Netflix basically said, look, it was hundreds of millions of dollars that we were just giving up for nothing. You know, we had a one time, like, yeah, the guy bought an iPhone and yes, they signed up for Netflix, but why are we still paying Apple 18 months later? Because this guy kept Netflix. Right. It has nothing to do with them, you know?
Right. Don't they have a thing in their store that if you buy something through an app in their store, you also get 30% on whatever.
Yeah.
So,
right, yeah. So if you subscribe to Office 365 through a Microsoft app on iOS, Apple would get 30% of that every year.
Right. Every time you re-up, you would get the charge
again. That's crazy.
Right.
That is crazy. Yeah.
If they even just drop that, I wonder if a lot of the complaint would disappear. If they just say, okay, one time, 30%.
Yep. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see how that goes. But I think this is going to dramatically impact. Because this is the precedent. Even in the Supreme Court ruling, they said our expectation is that Apple will have many more lawsuits as a result of this because it creates kind of a precedent. And I think that will expand to other markets, to Google Play and elsewhere. So I think this is a big deal.
And it was kind of a surprise, wasn't it? I felt like people thought it wasn't going to happen.
It was a close call, right? 5-4
vote.
I'm actually surprised they even took it on.
Yeah.
You know, frankly. But I'm glad they did. I, as a consumer, I've always been bothered by this kind of thing. And if you use, like the Kindle app, like I do on an iPad, or if you use the Audible app, you cannot, in those apps, visit the store.
It's really frustrating.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful.
That's the point. It's not a good user experience. This disadvantages users, not merely the developer, but the users as well.
That's crazy. Yeah. No. There's no justification for it. It's crazy.
Well, Apple's will be, but it's more secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure it is. So, I don't know. It's more lucrative, I think, for them is what.
We kind of had this conversation on MacBreak Weekly, and Jim Dalrymple of Loop Insight, who is an Apple journalist, said, no, but it is more secure. We celebrate that benefit. And I wish this story had come out then. Today, it turns out, you know, you probably read about it. This Israeli company that makes hacking tools. And says, but we only sell them to governments and law enforcement. Apparently, this hacking tool had been used to hack WhatsApp, if you're still using WhatsApp.
Leo, remind me, does Iran have a government? And does North Korea have a government?
It was almost certainly, by the way, Saudi Arabia. And it was this hacking tool. All it requires is that the bad guy make a phone call to your WhatsApp phone number. You don't have to pick up. You don't even have to be there. It will hack your device.
How did the Apple security in the store help that?
Didn't stop it. And, in fact, hindered it. And this is the article I just read today. It's very interesting. That the locked down nature of the iPhone keeps security researchers from discovering these hacks.
Yep.
And unless you jailbreak an iPhone, it's very difficult to determine whether it's been hacked.
So this is not the story that Apple tells on stage, Leo. I'm surprised.
No.
It's so different.
So in a way, by being so locked down.
Here's the problem. That people just accept this kind of nonsense. Mm. You know, it's more secure. Is it?
Apparently not. So the activists who have, you know, WhatsApp on an iPhone may well be hacked.
Right.
And have way.
You know, those guys are using iPhones.
Yeah, because it's more secure.
Well, because. Yes.
No, they are. If you ask people, Snowden and others, they won't use Android devices.
Right.
And that's, I think, maybe they're going to have to rethink that. Because
this whole thing is collapsing on Apple.
Apple's lock-in really is economic. Yeah. It's not about security.
No, of course. It's about lock-in. This is their advantaging their platform. Yeah. That's all it is.
And it's frustrating. I'm increasingly frustrated by it because, I pick up my iPhone now and I go, this thing is antiquated.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
compare this to a Galaxy S10. It's an antique.
Yeah. You know, in Russia, your iPhone calls you.
It does. It does. And WhatsApp picks up.
yeah, exactly. It's crazy.
All right. Enough. I'm sorry. Enough Apple bashing.
Sometimes I love this. I just am like, I can just sit here and like listen to this all day.
She's just literally eating popcorn. I'm just like, just enjoying
finally, it. Everyone is agreeing with me.
Yep.
Well, okay. But I have to say, on the other hand, from a point of view of developers, unless you're developing for .NET, an operating system with a Unix core like Mac OS is really preferred. And I think most developers who aren't developing for Windows prefer Mac OS or Linux. And I think that's why.
That's true.
That's exactly why you're going to see the Linux kernel in Windows.
All I will say to that is baby steps, and we're going to get there.
Paul and I, before the show, were telling Mary Jo that it's just a matter of time before Microsoft abandons the Windows kernel for the Linux kernel. To which Mary Jo responded,
"You're delusional."
Not with "shut your mouth."
Shut your mouth. What you talking? Well, maybe that is the way, because you're coming from the enterprise point of view, where the Windows kernel, everything is built on the Windows kernel. It's designed for the Windows kernel.
Right. I understand what you're saying. Like and we've said this for years, the OS matters less and less, especially as we start going the container route with VMs and apps being containerized. I agree with that, but I feel like it's so far away from a day when you can say to enterprise customers, "So, you know what? It's going to be Linux on the desktop instead of."
It's not going to be Linux on the desktop. What if it was Chrome OS on the desktop? What if it was this EdgeBook thing I'm talking about?
I think
it's essentially Linux underneath.
One of the benefits Microsoft gets by putting the kernel in for AWS is they're learning a lot about a Linux kernel on Windows. I don't think it'll look any different from Windows on Windows.
No, I think the Windows kernel. The Linux kernel on Windows makes sense. I can't ever see it being just Linux without Windows from Microsoft.
But you won't know the difference. The kernel, you know, who knows what the kernel is?
I know. You're right. The kernel versus the whole OS, right?
They got rid of Win32.
Right. If you have Windows experiences on a Linux kernel and no one could tell, would it matter?
Yeah. Exactly. As long as your legacy code runs, which it will. You don't care. And that's the move to .NET makes perfect sense. Listen, in that light.
If I wanted to watch a science fiction show on HBO.
Established that the number one operating system in the world is now Linux by far.
Well, and Azure, the largest number of workloads are Linux running on Azure. It's not Windows Server, right? I mean, or it's close. It's about 50-50. Well,
and one of the things Linus said is that what's going to slow ARM down is that if you're developing for ARM, you don't want x86 servers. So as we move to ARM, everything's up in the air. We throw it up in the air. And who knows? I mean, I'm sure in the lab, Microsoft's got a Linux kernel running on ARM with a Windows layer above it. Why not?
Possibly.
By the way, Windows XP is still checking for updates. Should Mondog awesome. Give up now?
Oh, boy.
I think he should give up.
Anyway.
But he better go get that patch while he's out there.
Yeah. While you're there, go to the catalog.
I don't know if going on the web is such a great idea.
Yeah. True. I think he had it air-gapped and just for us. He took his life in his hands, plugged it in.
You know, like an XP computer on the internet must be like a rabbit running into a wolf's den, you know, all the ears go up.
All that stuff is just endemically floating around looking for, please, I just need an RDS server, please. Anybody using RDS? XP? Anybody? Bueller? Xbox Game Pass Ultimate. I didn't even know such a thing exists. What is that, Paul?
So Microsoft announced this sometime in the past month, but in the future, what they're going to do is combine Xbox Live Gold, which is about $60 a year, with Xbox Game Pass, which is $10 a month, into a single service called Xbox Game Pass Ultimate. And the idea there is that right now they're only talking about the monthly fee. So if you look at it month to month, $15 a month, it doesn't actually represent a savings over just having the two things separate. But I'm expecting that they'll have 3 6-month and then probably 1 year subscriptions where, you know, the price comes down. So if you pay for the full year up front, you would pay less than if you were paying month to month, just like any other online service. That's speculation. I think it's pretty obvious they will go in that direction. But they're beta testing it with Xbox Insiders now. And if you sign up for today, if you can, you have to be – there's kind of a special beta program you have to be part of. But if you're able to do it, what they're going to do is give you credit for all of the months you have on each plan and add them together. So that means you're actually getting up to double the amount of time on the subscription, if that makes sense, right? So if you had, if you were to pay for 6 months of Xbox Game, actually 1 year, 1 year of Xbox Game Pass at $10 a month, $120, plus 1 year of Xbox Live Gold, $60, $180. But if you had that much credit in each account, you would actually get 2 years of the Xbox Game Pass Ultimate service. So it's actually worth like $360. So it's kind of a crazy deal. Like if you're able to get this in the preview beta, if you're an Xbox Insider, like sign up for this immediately. You're basically doubling the value of all of the subscriptions you've already paid for.
Can I become an Insider today and still do it?
I don't know. I bet you can. Yeah. I bet you can.
Go home and do this right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a no-brainer. Like, if you're assuming you're already subscribed to Xbox Game Pass, I guess, right? So, in other words, if you're doing both, and you see the value of this, and you could just sign up during the beta, like, why wouldn't you? They're going to extend your subscriptions out double the amount of time.
And when Game Pass Ultimate comes out, it'll be $15 a month.
Yes, but again, that's the same price as those two things are together today. What I'm hoping is that when it comes out, what they'll do is offer the ability to subscribe to longer periods of time for less, which is typical, right? So Xbox Game Pass today, for example, if you pay month to month, is $10 a month. So after 12 months, you would have paid $120.
I thought you had to be a gold member to even get Game Pass.
You do. So you're paying for both, right?
Right.
But if you pay for the whole year at once, it's only $100. So you save $20 by doing that. I'm hoping Xbox Game Pass Ultimate has the same kind of deal. You know, maybe you save 20% or whatever. That's probably more than 20%, whatever the number is, less than 20%. I can't do math. Anyway, the point is you save some percent.
Nice.
Let's work through the math there.
All right, Mary Jo, your long nightmare.
That wasn't too bad. That was one item.
Pretty quick.
And it was mostly math, bad math.
Bad math happened.
Always a highlight of the show.
Random numbers spouted as if by an expert.
This is why we're journalists.
It's twice as good and only half as much.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, just real quickly, we were doing a survey for particularly people like our listeners to Windows Weekly, how you use collaborative software at work if you use it. It's a brief survey, won't take but a few minutes, and it'll help us out. Go to twit.to/survey14. twit.to/survey14. If you wish to take that survey about how you use collaborative software at work, we won't tie your answers to any, you know, to you or to anything. It's all just in aggregate.
Or will we?
And what good would that do us? None. It's funny because of Facebook and Google, advertisers have this expectation. Well, I'll know everything there is to know about your audience, right? And we say no, but I can put a tracking pixel on your website, right? No. And we still get advertisers. So it just shows you people, our advertisers are classy, a classy bunch that really know just because you're geeks and listening to Windows Weekly that you're probably interested in something like, I don't know, Wasabi, hot cloud storage. The world is moving to the cloud. I don't have to tell you that. According to the Gartner Group, by 2025, in the next 6 years, 80% of enterprises, 80, will have shut down their data centers. That's 80% versus 10% today. Basically, everything's moving to the cloud. Massive migration. Because why? Well, cost savings, operational efficiencies. It's a new way to scale your business. You don't have to buy another hard drive. You've got them. They're up there. It's an infinite, in effect, an infinite resource you can expand into.
And I would submit one more thing. If you use the right hot cloud storage, it's even more secure than your on-premises storage. And I'll tell you what I mean in a second. Being able to efficiently and affordably store all that data moving to the cloud, an estimated 163 zettabytes by 2025. Go ahead and you can, I'll give you a moment to look up zettabyte on Wikipedia. Being able to efficiently and affordably store that data in the cloud is important. This is what businesses want. It's how they're going to innovate. It's how you're going to get an edge. There are, of course, lots of concerns, and I think security is a big one. I hear all the time. Cost is another one. That's why Wasabi is so timely. Wasabi was created by Jeff Flowers and David Friend. You know those names probably because they were at Carbonite. It was at Carbonite that they invented and patented a method for writing data on disks sequentially instead of, as you're doing it right now on your computer, in blocks. That meant that the disk reads and writes were kind of quantitatively more efficient and less expensive, 80% less expensive, and up to 6 times faster, and still more reliable. Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage. It uses this technique to save you 80%, to give you 600% speed increase, and 11 nines of durability. And that's as compared to Amazon's S3. They use the S3 API, so you already know how to use it. It's FINRA compliant, HIPAA compliant, CJIS compliant. And because you can designate some data as immutable, cannot be changed by anything, it's more secure. It is the best solution to protect you, for instance, from ransomware or fumble-fingered employees. No charge for API access. You're going to love that. No charge for egress. You're going to love that. That's another way they save you money. Calculate the savings for yourself. Start a free trial of unlimited storage for a month right now. That's an offer just for Windows Weekly listeners. Go to Wasabi, WASABI.com. Click the free trial link and enter the offer code Windows. Unlimited storage for a month. You should also ask about the Wasabi Ball. If you've got petabytes to migrate to the cloud, and I know many people do, the Wasabi Ball is the fastest, easiest way to do it. Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud and do it with the confidence of 11 nines durability and absolute security. Wasabi.com. Make sure you use the offer code Windows. We thank Wasabi so much for their support. I thank you for using the offer code Windows so they know you heard it here. Now it's time for the back of the book. Paul Thurrott, we're going to kick things off with your already telegraphed tip of the week.
So what I have this week are two app picks instead of a tip, because there are some pretty cool apps this week, including, by the way,
yes,
a new set of power toys, which is what you're referring to, that Microsoft is open sourcing and putting on GitHub.
What?
This is
the new Microsoft, baby. I love it.
It really is. They're kind of esoteric. You know, the first one is maximized to a new desktop, which is a little window control up in, that will be up in the corner of all the windows, so that you can maximize the current floating window to another desktop, virtual desktop, not a physical desktop, which would create that virtual desktop if you don't have one, which is, you know, semi-interesting. And then the other one is just a Windows key shortcut guide. In other words, you can, you know, Windows key plus X, for example, brings up that hidden menu that's off the start menu. There's a bunch of Windows key shortcuts that will vary depending on the state of the desktop. So it will bring up kind of an overlay that shows what those are.
But because it's open source on GitHub, you can look at the code, which I think is really kind of instructional.
Yeah. Right? What's kind of neat about this is, you know, PowerToys date back to Windows 95. And so I think, you know, 95, 98, and then XP again, they brought them back. They were really useful system utilities, almost all of which, by the way, were later incorporated into the operating system. So I went back and looked at some of the stuff I had written about in the Windows XP timeframe. And if you look at this stuff, it's like fast user switcher, which is the ability to switch to users right from a keyboard shortcut, I guess. But today you can do that right from the start menu, you know, for example, or the shell player, which is just a way to play MP3 files from the taskbar, task switcher, which is a new Windows at the time, Windows XP styled alt plus tab application, which they actually added to the system in Windows Vista as, what was that called? 3D flip, no, flip 3D. You know, the IE Find toolbar in an era where the Internet Explorer didn't have built-in Find right in the toolbar. Open command window here, which we absolutely still have. It's now PowerShell by default. PowerToy Calc, which is a graphing calculator, literally adding it to Windows 10 today, et cetera, et cetera. And if you kind of go down the list, like it's actually kind of interesting, like how many of these made it into Windows. And so who knows? Maybe you could write the next great Windows utility. If it's good enough, maybe Microsoft will add it to Windows.
I like that.
That's kind of cool.
That's cool. Yeah.
It is cool. The other one is we were talking about sets being quietly killed off and
deprecated.
Deprecated.
Can you say
it's we're exploding sets so that it can be more fruitful elsewhere or whatever. So obviously Microsoft is adding tabbed capabilities to the new terminal app. But if you want something that was exactly like sets and you want it in Windows today, you can get Groupie 1.2 from Stardock. And it is, I don't know if it's still on sale. When I wrote about this, it was on sale. Let me look at it now. It's normally $10. It is, let me see. It's still on sale. It's only $5. So if you want operating system tabs on every window and you can mix and match apps, you know, just like Microsoft promised to do, but it's actually here and it works, you can get Groupie.
Well, good on you, Microsoft.
Yeah. Thank you for making the third party application space more vibrant. Or something. Nice. I guess we're making, you know, lemonade out of everything now.
Yeah.
We are.
It's all good.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. So Mary Jo Foley, I think it's up to you to give us the enterprise pick of the week.
The enterprise pick is for anyone who would like to see what we journalists see ahead of a big show like Build. Microsoft took the 65-page book of news that they gave to us under NDA, and they put it out there for the public. So if you go to aka.ms/build2019 book of news, you also can download this giant document and see every single announcement Microsoft made at Build.
Is this what you guys used for?
Yeah, this is what we used to get, you know, to basically have a good overview of what was going to be announced to Build, and then we could pick and choose what we wanted to write.
You know what you didn't get, though, was the Frank Shaw hosted video virtual presentation where he literally changed shirts like Madonna between every scene, which I have to say I enjoyed quite a bit.
That was
entertaining.
That's
kind of fun. Yes.
Yeah.
And speaking of Build, if you keep hearing us talk about the sessions and how they recorded all the sessions, you don't even have to have been an attendee or paid or subscribed. You can go to microsoft.com/en-us/build and you can see all the videos. They didn't tape every single session, but they recorded most
of them.
You can
download
them.
They're on YouTube.
Yep. It's
all out there.
You can go watch any of these things that you would like for free.
Yes. Actually, that's a good tip. I strongly recommend you do that.
Yeah, I've been starting to go through some of them. And I mean, just because, you know, there were over 400 sessions in 3 days. So even if you went to Build, you couldn't have gone to all of them or even a good part of them.
Nice.
So go check them out. It's entertainment, free entertainment. You can like learn so many new things for free.
Sure can. And your code name.
Yes, my code name came from one of those sessions.
I love this code.
The code name is Tardigrade. Do you know what a tardigrade is?
It's every geek's favorite little animal.
It is. They're called water bears sometimes. They're these microorganisms that are allegedly the most indestructible creature ever. They can go into space and survive. They can be exposed to extreme temperatures and survive. Why is that the code name? Because Microsoft is working on a technology in Azure, codenamed Tardigrade, that's meant to help make their data center servers more resilient. Mark Rusinovich, who presented this session at Build, said, "We want our servers to be like tardigrades. We don't want them to have to reboot the virtual machine."
Did everyone look at each other like he had said something terrible and didn't understand what he was saying?
No, I think geeks know tardigrades.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, we love them.
And so his whole idea is, we're working on this technology, so if a server goes down in your data center, or at least in the Azure data centers, your VM gets frozen in RAM, so the state is preserved, and they can just move it over to another server without all your apps in the VMs crashing. Sounds amazing. We don't know when it's coming or if it will be available externally as well for people to use in their own data centers. But yeah, that's what Project Tardigrade is.
And I give you the friendly little tardigrade.
Well, how cute.
There he is.
Yeah, you don't want to see like one of those is in your stomach.
Probably not.
They're microscopic. I think you're probably all right. In fact, they probably already are in your stomach.
Yeah, I was they're just thinking the ugly. Same thing, actually.
Yeah.
They look like little centipedes with little threads coming off their little feet.
Yeah, they're cute. Yep. I just saw a tardigrade stuffed plushie.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's like a creature from Half-Life 2.
Yeah, but it's tiny.
Water bear.
It's a micro. It's like little.
Yeah.
I don't believe that's a bear.
No, the nickname is water bear for a tardigrade.
They're eight-legged micro animals, and they're going to outlive us all.
They are. Mm-hmm.
The Linux of the animal world.
It's what they are, baby. Tardigrade on the desktop.
Tardigrade on the desktop.
I think it's time for some beer, Mary Jo.
Yes, I do too. So I'm going to give you another beer pick from Seattle since we were out there last week. Everyone associates Seattle with super hoppy beers, but that's not entirely true. They have some other varieties of beer. And there's a brewery in Seattle called Machine House. It's in the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle. And they make a beer called Stinging Nettle Ale.
Yikes.
Well, they make a lot of English-style beer. So on the milder, lower ABV side, very drinkable. You can drink, you know, because they're 4% or 3%, you can drink them casually and not like a big IPA, you know, coming in at 8%. You can have more than one of these and be fine. So this Stinging Nettle Ale is a beer they brew with stinging nettles. And when you cook stinging nettles, the sting comes out of them, and they just have this nice, earthy, herbaceous kind of quality, which you can taste in this beer. It's one of the seasonal beers that they make at Machine House. And believe it or not, I learned this today. Hops are a distant relative of nettles.
Oh.
Nettles. So you could technically make a beer without hops and use nettles in place of the hops.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. I've had this beer. It's really tasty. It's just different. It's not like these overpowering IPAs that I love that just knock you over the head with the hoppy bitterness. You know, this is a mellow, amber-colored, nice, easy-drinking ale. So if you see Machine House beers anywhere, they're always good and always very mild. And just something nice to have. Paul's looking skeptical, but... You're like,
I didn't have a chance to enjoy any of your beers on this trip.
I know.
The keto is just killing you, Paul.
Or helping you.
No, I'm
actually
keto.
I think what's killing me, Leo, is the vodka and the and the whiskey.
But. Yeah. You take a whiskey take a vodka drink. That concludes Windows Weekly for this fine Tuesday afternoon. Except that it's Wednesday. But other than that, everything I said was a lie. We invite you to join us Wednesdays around about 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern time, be 1700 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can do that. Or listen live at twit.tv/live. If you do that, join us in the chat room where you can help us out with things like booting up Windows XP and seeing what happens. The chat room is at irc.twit.tv.
Who was the person that did that again? We should.
Good old Lawn Dog. Thank you, Lawn Dog.
Thank you
for putting your life on the line for all of us. We do this show, as I said, on Wednesday, but it comes out as a podcast usually by Wednesday evening. We edit them down and clean them up and take out all the cuss words. And
do you really do that?
You guys never cuss, so no.
We try not to. It might happen.
But if you did, we would take him out because
this podcast is like a scene from Deadwood sometimes. What are you talking about?
I'm rewatching Deadwood because I want to get to the movie they just released.
I know. Isn't that awesome?
Because it's the only way we'll ever know what happened. Let's see. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. Because we edit it, you can get it as a podcast to download. You can either go to our website, twit.tv/ww, go to youtube.com/Windows Weekly Show, or you can, I think that's the URL, or you can subscribe in your favorite podcast application, and that way it'll just download automatically. That's probably the best thing to do. Make it easy on yourself. Paul Thurrott He is in charge at Therat.com. Well, at least his name is on the masthead.
In charge is a strong term.
Yeah. He's got a lot of unruly employees. Thurrott.com. His books are at leanpub.com. Mary Jo Foley writes for Ziff Davis at allaboutmicrosoft.com. Ziff Davis. Do they even call it Ziff Davis anymore?
You just did. I know. ZDNet.
There's no Ziff. There's no Davis.
There is just a Ziff Davis, but that's not us anymore.
That's a different
company.
Remember
that whole split? Yeah.
I can't wait until I'm wiped off the map of my own site as well.
What do they say when you say, well, what does ZD stand for? You say it stands for nothing.
You say Ziff Davis, but it doesn't spell
it anymore.
Like ZDNet. HP, right? It's like HP.
Hewlett and Packard.
No one says Hewlett Packard, do they?
Yes, all the time.
They still do? You do?
I do.
I just say HP. Really,
yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe that's very old-fashioned. I'm going to be more old-fashioned and call it Hewlett-Packard and Ziff Davis Net, where she uses
it's on the moving
the
pictures.
Electronic calculator to write her articles.
Her typewriter?
Yeah. Her electronic typewriter. And there you will read them in the candlelight or a gas lamp if you're in the 20th century.
I'm ready for this world.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you all next time on Windows Weekly.